tax update for Saturday, May 27, 2006. Welcome to Tax Update. Indecent exposure this week, the dangers of outside networks. Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored this week by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners who subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Well, this week we're going to take a little bit of a break from tax matters and take a look at something, though, that's still important to you when you're out in the world and traveling as we're entering the summer vacation season. And now we're entering into the Memorial Day weekend for some people here who are on the road. And some of us are known from time to time to take work with us on the road. And we've discovered some interesting things. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably know a little bit about working with computers and working with information from the computer systems using the internet, since the podcast is delivered that way. And you probably have discovered that as you stay in hotels around the country, you've noticed that many of them now offer high-speed internet connections as either part of your standard package with the room or for an additional charge, which allows you to work on the road. We've also discovered that many coffee shops are offering you now Wi-Fi hotspots that you can log into your corporate network or log in and check your email while on the road or while traveling. So you take your laptop with you and you can basically be connected everywhere. Well, turns out there are some security issues here, that some of which you probably could suspect are there, but others you may not be aware of, that can be important in keeping data from prying eyes. Why is this important? Well, most of us operate under ethics rules that require that we keep confidential client information confidential. Secondly, even if you weren't operating under such rules, your clients presume and have a reasonable expectation that you're not going to expose their data. Some of the data that we have on our systems and some of the data that we regularly transmit to and from our systems has some very sensitive information, or some information to be very useful for things like identity theft. Now, as probably those of you who are CPAs are aware, the AICPA had an interesting problem or issue that many of us have received letters on about losing a hard drive with all kinds of personally identifiable information on it. And as you might suspect, as a client of the AICPA, if you're a member and got that letter, it doesn't make you feel very good to have an organization tell you that, oops, we might have lost your information. Well, I guess the good news in that situation is that it's kind of an obvious event that took place where the information is missing. In this case, the AICPA sent a hard drive out for repair. The hard drive got lost somewhere in the in-transit mode after it was the data was restored to the hard drive, apparently. So it's pretty obvious that there's a live set of data out there. But the problem we're going to talk about this week is a little more insidious and probably much more dangerous. This is how someone can gain access to information, and you're not even aware they gained the access. It's like somebody sitting in on your phone line doing the infamous wiretapping that, of course, has gotten in the news on the government side recently. But we're going to talk about it more from the standpoint of somebody being able to tap into and look at your data going back and forth, who doesn't need anything fancy, but can actually do it very easily and simply, and can gain access to the data in many situations where you may not be aware that you're exposing that data to the outside world. So we're going to talk to you about some of these issues. Now, many of these issues were covered in a number of podcasts that Steve Gibson and Leo Laporte presented on the Security Now podcast. Now, I've got the address for Security Now's podcast and their subscription lines in the materials this week that you can download. We've also got a reference to an article that describes the one technique we're going to talk about here in detail and how it works and the dangers it poses to you that is on Steve Gibson's site, because it's a little more involved and it might be nice to recheck the explanation as to how it works. But episode 29 is the major episode on the Security Now podcast, has this information. And if you want to go to the site that I give you, you'll find it archived in there so you can download and listen to those podcasts, plus the related ones both before and after that podcast that describe some of these issues in more detail. But today I want to look at it from the tax perspective, from the perspective of somebody who is in tax practice. Well, let's discuss what the problem is. The key problem really is that many, many years ago, eons ago, when the Ethernet networking was first being designed, the world was very different. We didn't have to worry about, nor could anybody really have easily foreseen, all these computers being connected and all this data going across. When the systems were first designed, we had incredibly expensive systems behind incredibly, tight security. And essentially, the average user, the average person, was not going to get his hands on a computer. So it really didn't matter, in many cases, about some of the issues that we run into today. So the original Ethernet had an implicit assumption that may not even been obvious to anybody at the time, because just didn't make sense not to make the assumption, that all the computers on the network were trustworthy. In the local area network you connect to, there is a very, very strong bias in the systems that all the other computers on your local area network, that is, the network connected in your system, inside your building, or connected to your wireless router, are good guy machines. We can trust that group. If you look at many of your firewall settings on your computer, you're going to discover that it does implicitly trust inside. That's true even in today's software with firewalls, largely because it needs to. We need to allow certain things to happen inside the wall. But that presents some real problems when we are all now going out and connecting to networks outside of our main network. We're talking about the hotspots and the hotels. Many of us regularly connect our equipment and our machines to networks outside the real world. Well, you may say, hey, I've got that covered. I have my firewall configured, so when I'm on one of those networks, I don't trust the outsiders. I basically shut down inbound incoming connections. I limit myself, etc., so I should be fine. The problem is the Ethernet design still doesn't make that fine. Even with all that in play, you can still find your data compromised a number of fashions. Well, what's our problem? A key issue arises from the fact that we have two types of addressing we have to deal with to talk about what your machine is. Now, I'm sure you've all seen the little dotted addresses. Those that say, like the computer I'm working on right now, has a dotted address. If I call up in Windows, call up the command line, type in ipconfig in Windows XP, I'll get a listing. It'll tell me that my current IP address, and right now it tells me on the machine I'm using at this instant, my IP address is 192.168.1.109. Now those dots are kind of interesting, but basically that address is divided into fours. Those fours are what are known as a hierarchical address. Now, my machine, when I unplug it from this network and I go back, let's say, and plug it back in, I'm now sitting here at home behind my home router, but I can take it to my office, plug it into the office network, I will be assigned a new IP address. The IP address changes depending upon what I'm hooked to. Also, as an aside, those of you who are aware of these things know that that 192.168 address is an internal address. That tells my router, and also basically everything on the internet knows, that that address is not routed to the outside world. That's an inside address. But we'll ignore that for the moment. What we do, though, those addresses, when they go to the outside world addresses that aren't in the ranges that are reserved for inside use, basically, when my router gets it, if I try to connect to one of those, like when I connect to Libsyn to upload this podcast to their servers, my router will get an address that has different numbers, will not have the 192.168. It will know it goes to the outside world. When it receives that, it passes it upline, if I'm uploading from here, to, at this point, Cox Communications router. That router takes a look at that address. It probably still doesn't know where a Libsyn computer is sitting, but it does know that that address tells it which direction generally it needs to keep moving the data. And each of the subdots are kind of subnetworks. It tells us we have 255 initials in the starting block. That's what that first set of numbers that is now 192 in the address I gave you can be anything supposedly from 0 to 255. That tells the machine essentially which router, where to move this data to get it closer to that location. Eventually it gets to the right first level and starts moving down line, and from that point, once it's in that direction correctly, it moves to the next one below and then down so far. And finally, the last address there in those four dots tells it down to the specific machine. So it will keep moving at that direction, and eventually, because it keeps passing off in directions, it will get to the Libsyn computers, and the podcast will be uploaded there. It's very similar, the example that was used in the Gibson podcast, to how we handle addressing letters. I address a letter here, and let's say I'm going to send it to somebody in Seattle, Washington, and it will have Seattle, Washington, and a street address in Seattle. Now, when I give it to my mailman here, he probably has no clue what the streets look like in Seattle, Washington. In fact, it may even be a small town in Washington. He has no clue what that town is. If you send to somebody in Ajo, Arizona from Seattle, odds are the person in Seattle for the Postal Service who picks up the letter will have no clue what in the world Ajo, Arizona is or where it is. But what they do know is how to direct it towards Arizona. As it gets to the Arizona group, we know how to direct it to Ajo. And as it gets to Ajo, it finally gets to the postman who does the delivery route, and that person then handles it with the street and the address number. So that is a system that allows letters to get to very specific locations, but that doesn't mean that everybody who picks it up, in essence the postal employee in this case being like your router, has to know exactly how to carry it straight to that address. Rather, they know how to hand it off and move it in the proper direction. Well, that's IP hierarchical addressing. It's great. The problem is, as we note, your computer moves from network to network and it's moving all over the place. Inside the network, there's a problem. I've got to be able to identify your machine, even though that number, while that number is helpful to the outside world to get it to you, it's not going to help me inside the network because I need to get to your specific machine. Your machine has what's called a MAC address, Media Access Control address. And that's a long string of letters and numbers. It's actually a hexadecimal number, which means it's letters from A to F and numbers from 0 to 9. And that's the actual address of your machine or name of your machine. Every device that connects to the Ethernet, that can connect to the Ethernet, is supposed to have a unique MAC address. They're assigned to manufacturers. They assign it to the actual components they kick out. So the laptop I'm working on right now has one MAC address. My router has another MAC address. Every computer in my office has a different MAC address. Your computer has a MAC address right now if it connected to the internet. And basically, these are the physical locations, and your computer really knows or finds out about data coming to it via that address. What happens is, internally in your network, that dotted address, that is the IP address, is assigned via tables to the MAC address of specific machines. So we have this dual addressing code. Ethernet was designed initially, if you remember back in the old days, those of us who are around remember wiring the initial Ethernet networks in our organizations using coaxial cable, that nice little black round cable, that hooked in the back of each machine and strung from room to room to room. So there was one long cable going through the whole building. And that was a great piece of fun, because if anything ever broke anywhere along that cable, your whole network went down, like the old Christmas tree syndrome that you had with the Christmas tree lights, where if one light goes out, the whole string goes out. Now we have to find out which one went bad. Same issue there with the bad piece of cable. We had to find out where the bad piece of cable was so we'd bring the network up. It didn't just take down the machines connected to the bad piece of cable. It took down every machine in the building. But that was the initial design. Now, the other factor there, besides the fact that one break in the cable brought down the whole network, the other issue that has to happen at that point is, well, how does data get from one machine to another? What it means is, in that scenario under Ethernet, it was designed so that whenever a packet had to go from one machine to another, my machine would assemble the packet and in the header would basically put in there the MAC address of the machine that was to receive this data. But it would broadcast on that wire and every machine would receive that packet. What happened is that packet came into your network card. Your network card took a look and said, is this my address? If your network card discovered it was its address, it took the data, passed it on to the computer. If the network card found it wasn't its address, it was supposed to basically ignore the packet. But your card saw every packet that went by it. Now, to get around that initially and get around the fact that wiring that was kind of a pain and was stringing that one long wire and then finding the break was a pain, we eventually went to a different system where we centrally located or hooked to what was known at the time as a hub, but still is known as a hub. Now, what that did said was we're going to run one wire from each machine to a central point and then have that central point basically be where we tie it in. Therefore, we don't have the one string going through the whole building. We have everybody wiring back to a central location. That makes it a lot easier to add machines to the network. It also makes it a lot easier that when a line goes dead, only the machine hooked to the dead line is taken off the network and everybody else can stay active. Now, those initial hubs, though, still rebroadcast every signal down every line. Why? Well, at the time when this was rolling out, it was much more expensive to design a system that would have to have the intelligence, because it would need intelligence in that central hub to only send the data to the machine that was supposed to receive it. While clearly we could do that now because we had it physically connected to a physical line, the hub had to be able to know where that data was going and where that machine was on the network. Obviously, it was kind of expensive at the time to build systems to do that. It would add processing power. So what the initial hub system did, since its main job was to solve that broken line problem, was simply retransmit all data down every line. So even though we had now broken that string of connections, it still was true that every machine in the building saw every single packet of information. Now we go to the third and the method that's used most often today for wired networks, and that is the switch. What happened eventually was that the price of adding that intelligence to that central unit went down, and we went to what was called switch networks. In a switch, what happens is when that data comes in, the intelligence in that central location determines which machine, based upon its table of addresses, is supposed to be receiving this data. And it sends that signal only down the line to that machine and not to the others. As you might guess, that eliminates a lot of transmission and traffic going to your individual machines. As well, it would apparently help significantly with security, because now we don't have all this data going to every machine on the network that can just be read. And it does help some with security, but we'll get into what some of the problems and issues are. But those basically were your methods of hooking up to a network. Now, why is this still important? And why do we still worry about this? Well, there are a couple of issues. You might say first, okay, obviously everybody would be using hubs now, so what's the issue, or be using switches now, so what's the issue? Well, it turns out there are two key times when likely you're not in a switch configuration, but you are into the standard hub style configuration where all the data is coming through to your system. First method, those high-speed wireless networks in hotels. Many of them were added and put into the system. The hardware came in back in the days when hubs were still significantly less expensive than switches to install. Because of that, about half of the hotel networks, based upon an informal survey that Steve Gibson notes in one of his podcasts, it appears that about half of the hotel networks out there, just on this informal survey, were using hubs. So that means that when you connected to a hotel network, you got to see all the data everybody on your segment of the network sharing your hub was transmitting. Now, that segment could very well be the whole hotel. Depending upon the size of the hotel, it could be a subpart of it, but you saw a lot of traffic. Why is that important? Your machine's only going to pick up the data coming in, right? Everybody else is going to do that. Well, no, not really. There are tools available, very easily available, called sniffers. A sniffer tool can switch your network card on, presuming it supports a mode called promiscuous mode, and most network cards support that. That will basically allow it to grab and log all transmissions, not just the ones that are supposed to be coming to it. The same network security person whom Steve Gibson cites for the one half of all hotel networks or hubs found that on average night, if she was connected to a hub-based hotel network, she could pick up approximately, she indicated, 180 email address logins and passwords. Why? That data is transmitted in the open. Also, clearly, any other data that was transmitted. Now, the nasty tools out there have intelligence available for them that can scan for nice little things that may look interesting, like social security numbers, credit card numbers, and any other types of data it may like, or log in things like email logins. The standards are pretty well known for how that works. So there is a serious risk there if you're in a hub environment. Now, is a hotel going to post in front of you automatically on your door that this network uses a hub? And that your data is going to pass over the Ethernet card of every other machine on this hub? Probably not. So the odds are, unless you're technically savvy and check, you're not going to know that you are on a hub environment. Secondly, even more widespread, we're adding hub-type equipment. Where? Wireless networks. If you think about it, in a Wi-Fi environment, the only thing the wireless router can do is transmit all data to all machines. It does not have a separate channel or separate frequency for every machine on the network. It simply doesn't work and isn't feasible. So all data coming back to your wireless network is transmitted out. Unlike with the switch, there is no physical wire running to my machine. That means that the data transmitted to me comes to my machine, but is sitting out there for every machine on my network, plus any other piece of equipment that might be able to read that transmission. Now, you may say, aha, well, that's fine, but I don't use unsecured Wi-Fi. I always use a secured wireless network, meaning one that runs under WEP or one that runs under WPA encryption, and that's fine. Only problem. WEP and WPA only protects you against computers that aren't a member of the network and don't have those passwords. Once you have those passwords, I can read all traffic on the network. Secondly, if you're using WEP, something you need to be very aware of, the older standard for wireless security that came out with most 802.11b cards, the original wireless standard, that security can be easily, very easily broken. In fact, in a few minutes, essentially, you can get into virtually any WEP-enabled network with tools that are available for download on the internet. So if you are connected to a WEP network, somebody who is not a member of the network but wants to see what goes on in it can get into that network with very little effort and find out what you're transmitting. Well, maybe you think, okay, switches will solve all this. Now, just beyond switch networks, and I'll only use wired switch networks, I'm actually going to check every hotel to make sure. Well, there's a second problem that Steve describes in more detail called man-in-the-middle attacks. What is this? Well, we told you Ethernet is trusting. Remember that bit I talked about initially where we have a MAC address that's assigned to the IP address? Well, your machine on the local network is going to basically send to a MAC address. Well, how does it know which MAC address to go when everything Ethernet's going IP? Well, it figures out where to go by having a table inside of it that maps MAC addresses to the assigned IP addresses. Now, one of the more important IP addresses on your local network is what's called the gateway. That's essentially your way out to the outside world. If you run that IP config in Windows XP that I talked about to start this from the command line, you're going to find that it will tell you your gateway. Well, you notice when you list that, Windows just tells me the gateway based on a dotted address. But internally, your machine has a mapping that says that dotted address is this MAC address. How does it find out that mapping? Well, it's told it by the machine that has it. Well, you know, what if that machine were to change? Well, if that machine were to change on the network, what happens when it comes up new? The new machine gets assigned that and will have that IP address. We get a new gateway. The MAC card's changed in that machine. It would send out a notice to your machine saying, this is the new mapping for this IP address. Here's the hitch. There is no confirmation, no security. Your machine will blindly believe whatever it is told. If any machine on the network comes up and says, I'm the gateway, I am now the new gateway computer, your machine will say, that's good, I've changed my tables, I'll now follow that. Well, let's take a look and see what happens when that goes on. So your machine then, when it wants to send to the outside world, will send to that gateway machine. Now let's posit a bad guy. Or let's even go one more step. How does that gateway machine know how to get to yours? Well, the gateway machine, of course, got a signal from your machine telling it that this is my IP address and I'm the machine that's at that address. This is the MAC address. And that can be changed as a new machine comes on. It can basically tell the gateway the same thing, similar message, and no confirmation of that. Now I'm the bad guy. I'm going to come in and I will now put myself between you and the gateway. How do I do that? Simple. I send a message to the gateway. I discover by reading the traffic, or however I want to do it, I kind of discover by listening to the traffic on the network. Being I'm on the network, I'm trusted. I can get things. I can send data back and forth. So I will determine what the MAC address is for your machine by basically listening in, following the network traffic. And I know what the MAC address is for the gateway. So now I send a couple of messages. My machine sends a message to your machine telling your machine that I am now the gateway computer. The gateway computer's MAC address has been changed to the MAC address of my machine. So your computer now is told when it wants to send to the outside world, it sends to my MAC address. I then tell the gateway computer that I am your computer. So I tell the gateway when it has data to come to what is your computer, it's to send it to me. Now, what I do is I make sure when you send machine data to go to the outside world, you send it to me. I log that data, then I turn right back around and I send it on to the real gateway, which will then get processed and go to the outside world. Similarly, when that gateway receives data for you, it comes to me. I log that transmission to find out what's going on. But then I send that data on to you. You are none the wiser. What's the hitch? There's no authentication in this process. Nobody proves that who you're talking to is who you think you're talking to. Now, there are authentication mechanisms in the internet, and that's the hitch that runs into this. There is a sign that you're stuck with a man in the middle. The key thing that will tell you this is something known as a certificate. If you go to a secured website, HTTPS website, and you attempt to log in on a secured website, the man in the middle computer can't really transmit that back to your machine properly and keep it in, make it look like it's still the secured data. In order to decrypt that data, he has to decrypt it. And when he sends it on, due to some issues that are involved in how this works, while he can encrypt it and he can make it look encrypted coming to you, he can't basically give you the signal that's going to show it really is coming from PayPal. Well, what he'll do then, because PayPal certificate says essentially, this is, you know, that uses a trusted third party that can be proven via various mechanisms in your machine through electronic signatures, that's really the PayPal certificate. Well, he has to fake it, but he probably will get by with it. Why? Because what's going to happen is your machine now will say it can't verify the PayPal certificate. Should it accept this certificate? When you say yes at that point, he's got you because your machine now will always accept that certificate, and you're now just basically stuck, and he can continue to send data to and from your machine. In fact, can read your encrypted traffic now since he decrypts it. You're basically sending encrypted to him. Then he can re-encrypt it and send it to PayPal, who won't be aware anything happened, or send it to Amazon or anyone else, or the AICPA, or I should say AICPA probably doesn't care. That's not usually their problem. But send it on to your tax program by basically having interposed himself as the man in the middle and accepted the data. And there really is no good way to fix this easily under these methods as long as you stay open on that network. Well, what are your solutions? Well, the HTTPS thing tells us some of the issues that probably would help solve this. That is, you need an authenticated connection. How can you do that? Virtual private network. Now, a VPN is a useful solution, and there really are two ways you'd use one. And there are two types we need to worry about here that would be used. First, you can have a VPN back to your home network. What that does is create an encrypted tunnel between you and that location. The second important thing that it does is it has an authentication protocol in it. That is, it proves that the machine at the other end is really the machine at the other end you expect to be talking to. And the machine that is decrypting this traffic is the machine you expect to decrypt. The data that goes through that tunnel is totally scrambled, so even if a man in the middle were to grab it, it doesn't make any difference. It can't do any good. So basically, a VPN is a very useful tool to be using on these networks. Now, the problem is you need to set one up. Now, you can VPN back to your local area network. That's one option. A bit more involved, required if you want to share data or connect back to your local network, but many of you who are doing that probably already have such software in place. However, let's say you're a small firm and you're not really too interested in maybe always connecting back local, or maybe you are but on a limited basis, but you're also very concerned with just being able to connect out on the road on your hotspots, connecting out and just checking your email. Well, there are a couple of third-party solutions that will give you a VPN to their machines, which will then get your internet data out onto the internet from a known location and scrambled till it gets there. So you can secure yourselves to their location and from their location then be able to transmit out over the internet. So you would bypass the third party who may be trying to grab your data or sniff your data. Because that's the other catch, as noted. If we're in the hub situation, we're not doing anything fancy with the man in the middle. We just watch the data as it goes by. In that scenario, you can sign up with these organizations. Now, I've got a couple of them noted in the show notes. One is publicvpn.com and hotspotvpn.com. Both of them are subscription services. Both of them you buy, you install a piece of software, and when you connect to these outside networks and want to get a secure line out to the internet so that your traffic won't be grabbed, so you can do things like check your email without worrying about giving away your email password and logins, you connect and you basically run them. Once they're running, all internet traffic runs through them. It does slow you up a bit, not terribly, but some. But it does cause the traffic to be such that it can't be easily grabbed by the third party. Maybe you want to run, though, back to your home network. If so, there are a couple of ways to pull that off. If number one, of course, you can get a VPN installed. Not a bad idea, but let's say you're not going to go there. You're not technically going to go that direction. You don't, you know, you're a solo practitioner. You really have one machine. You only want to do some limited work. In that case, you may want to take a look at a couple of services, one that is free and one that is a subscription service. If you just want a VPN to be able to basically get back to file shares on your local machine, you might consider the Hamachi project. That's at hamachi.cc. That will basically give you a fix to the VPN issue. And the big problem with installing a VPN is routers aren't really designed to let you get inside the network. They're very good from a security standpoint, but they essentially don't like unknown traffic just kind of knocking on the door. You have to go through setups to get the unknown traffic to get through the door. So if you're trying to log in from the road, your machine's coming from a random address. It's not been asked for by any machine inside your local network. Therefore, your router, at least initially, is going to say, I don't know who you are, goodbye. Hamachi handles that by using, basically, if Hamachi is running on the machine inside your network, Hamachi's running, you fire up Hamachi on your machine in the random third party, it interposes a machine temporarily, a location, a server temporarily, to do the link up and hook the two machines together. And then those two machines now know from here forward, basically they can handle the traffic with each other. No data passes through Hamachi after the initial link up. And in fact, the passwords and all the encryption are all stored locally, so they have no method of getting into your machine. It's a very nice project. It's a good thing to look at and take a look at if you're just trying to get things like share files or printers remotely. That is a useful project. A little bit simpler if you really want to run programs from the remote location, though it is a paid project, is Citrix's GoToMyPC. Not quite as fast, perhaps, as some of the other solutions. Real VNC is also a possibility with Hamachi that you can run remotely. You want to wrap Real VNC around something like Hamachi. You really want to after the recent security hitch that was discovered. There are probably other hitches that'll be there, so it's one of those things to do. You also can wrap with Hamachi Windows Remote Desktop via that mechanism. The problem with that is it's a bit more complex to get it set up because Windows Remote Desktop needs Hamachi to run as a service. The problem is if Hamachi is running under your user account, you try to log into your user account, your machine will essentially crash because it's going to try to log out of the first one and that'll take Hamachi down and everything will kind of go south from there. So you need to be able to run Hamachi as a service. There are some instructions for doing it, but it's not the simplest solution. GoToMyPC is a bit easier and runs a bit faster. It also gets by the network, and it allows you to run from a remote location. Now, it only works with Windows machines for purposes of the host, the machine you're going to run remotely. But it can work with other clients. Anything that can run Java can be the machine that logs in to the remote machine. It is a useful tool. It will also do file transfers and some printer sharing. It will not, however, allow you to just share the file in the same way you would share if you're connected to the local network. If you want to be able to open files easily on your remote machine, edit them, save them back to the main network, the Hamachi solution is much cleaner. If you want to be able just to bring up your remote computer, do your editing on the remote on your computer back at the office and save on the local area networks, then probably GoToMyPC works better. The problem with the second solution is there will be a bit of a lag depending upon your connection speed, and you may find that more or less frustrating. Different people find different levels of frustration in that area. The key thing to remember is that when you're on the road and connected to an unknown third-party network, you need to be taking some steps to preserve your client's data. You do not want to be put in the position the AICPA was of having to send letters to your clients telling them that your data may have been exposed, and you probably should register with the credit bureaus to check for fraud alerts. That's not a good letter to have to send to your clients, and as the AICPA discovers, it has some consequences that aren't much fun for you going forward. Now, this has been Tax Update. The Tax Update podcast is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. We'll be back with you next week as we get into the summer and get into June now, and here in Phoenix it's beginning to heat up. We'll see you next week with hopefully some more tax topics, and we'll get back into the tax side of the issues. This has been Tax Update.